Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Yes, yes, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we know it is a battlefield every day. It's like that movie, One Battle, what is it? Every battle, every time, every...
One battle after another. Just,
one battle after another, and that's what it feels like these days, one battle after another. We could have entitled that movie, but yeah, we got a lot to talk about, but I'm going to put some stuff up first so that we get that out of the way. One is that tonight is an emergency meeting of the state takeover of the police. So we want people to be there at 6 p.m. at the Northside Movement Center. And that's the new center on the north side that was opened up by RTD Defenders and Action St. Louis. So if you hadn't got a chance to see it, come to the meeting and you can do two things at the same time. So this is where we're going to strategize going forward. So we're trying to bring as many forces as possible. So 6 p.m. tonight at the Northside Movement Center. And I don't know the exact address, but it's on my website. So there's something on there that gives you all the information. The other thing I just have to say is just really thanking people for the outpouring of support when you all found out that the 46th anniversary of the Organization for Black Struggle had been canceled by the University of Missouri. So I think that really helped to ground us to say, don't get all upset. This too shall pass and we'll figure it out. And we will. So thank you for that. People offering alternative places, attorney, Walker, Cheryl Walker decided she wanted to do a fundraiser on her Facebook page and she's done that. So thank you all for those contributions towards our work. Yeah, it was a disappointing time, but you know, this is what these people do. They bow to pressure when they don't have to. And this is a state university that really should have been standing firm because they claim always to have this solid community engagement mission, and yet they were quick to cancel that. So the other thing is, I just want to let you know what's coming up on Voices from the Battlefield. Next Wednesday, Jobs with Justice will be joining us because the Organization for Black Struggle and Jobs with Justice have been working on anti-protest legislation for the last 5 or 6 years. And we've been like leading the forces that we've been able to beat that back for that many years. But each year it gets harder and harder, as you can imagine. But we are going to bring them on, and we're going to talk about where we are in that struggle and that campaign, as well as some other anti-democratic legislature that's coming up on the state level. So you don't want to miss that. Also this month, we'll be interviewing Uhuru Chair Omali Yesichelli, and we're going to be hearing about the appeal process that they're going to be engaging in July. But this month there is a conference that they'll be holding to talk about that and to do other planning, and that's this month. I think it's the 17th, the weekend of the 17th. So you'll get more information about that. And lastly, we're going to have people from Minneapolis Battlefield who've been on those fronts who will come and give us an update. Because, you know, when stuff goes off the mainstream media, it's almost like it doesn't exist anymore. But those folks are still fighting. They're still on the battlefront. ICE is still there in some form. And so we'll hear directly from those folks. So we're going to tackle quite a few issues today. This is Black Commentator Wednesday, and you know that's when we bring some of the writers from blackcommentator.com on to talk about certain issues because they got opinions. We all got opinions on everything, and the thing I think that really connects us is, one, we're all history buffs. We all believe in connecting the dots in terms of intersectionality. We all have a passion for writing and educating and engaging people. So that's what we're going to do today. So with me today on this sector is Bill Fletcher, who is a labor organizer from 4 years, I used to say for a couple of decades, but now, woo, now it's some more decades added on to that. And then we have Elwood Watson, who is a history professor at the East Tennessee State University. So he's in the South with us in Missouri. So we ought to try to hook up sometime, Elwood. So they're gonna come, we're gonna be talking about some stuff. So first thing I want to talk about, y'all, is the UN vote on slavery. Some of us, I don't know if you were there, Bill, for the International Conference on Racism that was held in South Africa. I was there, and we got pretty close to getting some consensus on the whole slavery issue. But here the UN decided we're going to take a vote on this. And guess who the three votes were that opposed the whole notion that slavery was the worst thing that could happen to mankind? It was the US, Israel, no surprise, and Argentina. So of all the nations in the world, those are the ones who said, no way, Jose. So there you have it. So what do you think that vote really means? I mean, it's, in some ways it's symbolic, but pretty powerful, particularly at this point in our history.
Was that for?
Either one of y'all can just jump in. Conversation.
Okay. I would say to me, okay, I would say that that it was it's the United States has always had a to realize slavery is the original sin, as we say, as someone said in history, and they have been very reluctant to acknowledge it, you know, and it's just something they know it's brutal, it's rapacious, the spirit as slavery has a rapacious spirit. It's brutal, it's violent, it was dehumanizing, demoralizing, and there was nothing positive about it. You know, even when you had Black conservatives like Tim Scott and Byron Donalds denouncing it, you know that, you know, when they say there's nothing, there was no silver lining in slavery, you know it was bad. So there's no way you can justify slavery. But the United States realizes that it's something that they really don't want to admit that it was the original sin, and they realize that it was because of slavery that the United States became the nation that it is today. You know, the Black people built this nation. This nation was built on the Blacks of Blacks. Okay. And acknowledging that realizes that that debt has not been paid to Black America. Has America paid that debt? No. So therefore, that is a reason why people will deflect, deny, decry any effort to say, to address the injustices that slavery had at the very beginning and the inception of this century, even up to the present day. Slavery is still with us. Its ramifications are still with us this very day, almost 400 years later. And this is not any, you know, people are like, oh, slavery is over. Well, no, that's ridiculous. I mean, slavery is over, but the reality is the actual enslaving of people is over. The institution of itself, the legalized slavery, yes, it's over. But it's still, its effects are still with us. They use that analogy. That's just like saying, well, the Holocaust is over now. That was something almost 100 years ago. The point is, the effects of the Holocaust are still there. There's a very dearth of Jewish people on earth because of the Holocaust, okay? Anti-Semitism still exists. I mean, people are like, because slavery is over, racism is gone, or it's because the Holocaust is over, the anti-Semitism is gone. That's insane. I mean, you know, women got the right to vote.
Yeah,
that didn't prevent sexism from evaporating. It's an ongoing struggle. And human beings, by their very nature, as Frederick Douglass always once said, power concedes nothing without a demand. And if you look at what's going on right now, the point is, Audre Lorde, she's been there for about 30 some odd years now. The point is, when she said the war against dehumanization is ceaseless, you couldn't put any better, you know?
Yeah. So I'm wondering, we feel that and know that, well, some of us know that and feel that in this country. What about the rest of the world, Bill? What does that mean for them to add their voices to say that? What's the intent, and what can we continue to amplify in terms of the struggle here in the U.S.?
So it seems to me, Jamala, that there's like several things that are going on here. One is, at a general level, most countries don't really want to come to grips with their own histories. They'd rather mythologize their histories than deal with the complications and contradictions of their histories. So that is like pretty much across the board. So the fight for the over history is like its ongoing battle in every country, and it's never ending. Second thing is, for the United States, I could put a dollar to a donut that one of the things that's a very big concern for them is liability financial liability, that if they vote and acknowledge what the UN was putting in that resolution, I can just imagine someone in the State Department saying, we're opening ourselves up to countless lawsuits. And then the third thing is very particular to the moment that we're in, which is the active erasure of the history of traditionally marginalized populations, including but not limited to African Americans. So you got all three of these things that are in operation. And so it was wonderful that most of the UN voted in favor of the resolution, despite their own histories. I don't be cynical, right? I mean, it was really good because it gives us a platform. It gives us a club that we must use in fighting erasure, that the entire world, with the exception of these three countries that for their own reasons are voting this way, the entire world is acknowledging the massive criminality of slavery. So,
yeah, I'm thinking that those lawsuits have been forthcoming for a while. I mean, so I don't know why one would be afraid of that. And the issue of reparations is not going away. And I know it's coming in different forms. Different communities have been successful on various levels to get some reparations, but it's not been like the total thing for all descendants of African enslaved people. So I thought it was a big plus. I mean, I really did. And I thought it also was a nose thumbing at the US and Israel, just based on what they're doing now. In terms of the genocide of the Palestinian people. So I begin to think about like how could we amplify around the reparation struggle here? And I think that's an ongoing process in terms of what that looks like and who's doing the work on the ground. But I saw it as a big plus. So thank you for that. I'm gonna move us now to the No Kings, protest over the last weekend. You know, millions came out, more than came out, you know, it seems like a few million come out every time, even though they're saying there's some cities or some areas where they've seen the decrease, and I'm interested to see what's causing that. But what now, I guess? We got plenty of momentum going. Where does that momentum go? And either one of you all can jump into that.
I would say, you keep going forward. I mean, there are people who have criticized the No Kings movements as being performative or whatever. Well, my point is, what's the alternative? I mean, I don't know if it's performative for everybody. I think there are people who are genuine. You're going to find any movement, I mean, that's going to have people in it for performative reasons or even opportunistic reasons. But that doesn't mean that the noble intention of the movement in and of itself doesn't mean the movement itself doesn't have noble intentions. And it certainly can be beneficial, and it can have a beneficial outcome at the end. So, I mean, what's the alternative? Just to stay home and say nothing or do nothing? It's just like, to me, that reminds me almost of the people who say that it was like during the civil rights movement, the blacks who were critical of the whites who did participate in the movement, but the blacks who, but these same black people did not. I mean, okay, you know, so, you know, well, at least they're out here. I mean, they're out here, you know, for people who are not even of their ethnicity, and they show they have a humanitarian spirit in them, and they're concerned about the welfare of their brother or sisters, whereas you're not even, your group of people being directly impacted from it, and you're not even involved. So my point is, I just think that argument about, the lack of performative or the performance spirit in me, I think that's just, largely, that's a cop-out for people who don't want to, acknowledge the reality of the situation. You know, it's easier to criticize as opposed to be actively involved. Now, that being said, to get to your meat of your question, look, you that in and of itself is not going to be enough. Yes, you're going to have, then you need to get people on state legislatures, town, community, local boards, like what you're doing in St. Louis and areas like that as well. And to get more, get involved in local government. That's where it's going to really start. Local government, it's almost like a grassroots effort. And you've got to start the local, state, and federal level. But it's almost I call it a trickle up. You start and then you work your way up there. That's how, and I think for the longest time, I think the left, liberals felt pretty much as long as you have the White House and you have, the federal government, you're okay. Well, that's all and good, but the government is multi-layered, and you can't just simply assume that because, you have the White House, or you have you got power in Washington, your party is the majority of Washington, that that's going to be good. The conservatives learned it quickly. They learned that, you get on these school boards, you get on these, you get in the state governments, you affect it at the local level, because that's what's going to affect you the most. The local level is going to affect you the most. It's like a presidential pardon, for example, that doesn't take care of a state pardon. The president can pardon you, but you still are responsible if you've committed a crime at the state level. So I'm just saying, they realize, the government is very, very multi-layered and multi-sectored. It's just not that, I think sometimes the left has always thought somehow the government in and of itself is just one, and
One monolithic thing.
The federal government takes care of everything, and it's just not that way. But I do think that the No Kings was good. I mean, and the numbers were there. And here in my town in Johnson City, I mean, we're a town of I'd say about the town itself is a town of about 100,000. But there are people out protesting on Saturday as well. You saw when you were driving by things as well. So yeah, it was there. And this is a college town too, to be sure. But I think it was a very positive development. Now, in and of itself, is it going to be enough? No, because we know that. But it is an effort to let people know we don't want a king. We don't want authoritarian rule in our nation. And I think that's probably a and I think there was a bipartisan effort there. Did anybody see that woman that I think it might have been a Fox News reporter who asked this because there's been always trying these little wedge issues. Well, how come there are not too many black people here protesting? Is it like it's wrong with white women? And he asked a white woman herself, and it was like he goes, well, how come what do you think the dearth of people of color is really pretty much overly white, black? She goes, first of all, I don't think black people should be out here. She goes, because black people themselves are more likely to be targeted by the police and arrest. I mean, and you can see he was just flummoxed. That was not the question he was expecting. I think he was looking to see, well, it's a shame we would like to have more of our fellow black folks out here and everything else. But she just turned it right around. He was fumbling for words. So I was like,
Yeah, I saw that one. I saw that one.
okay, so you know what I'm talking about. Okay, good. I mean, it was like, I mean, she just like, I mean, it was like, he didn't, he was not expecting that. You could just see he was like, he literally had to catch his breath. He's like, oh. I wasn't expecting that response. I mean, she just,
And he didn't even have a follow-up question.
exactly. I mean, she just, he just, I mean, she just laid it on. I mean, she wasn't mean, but she just, just threw it out there and said, no, well, we're the ones that you're out here protesting on their behalf.
Well, you
So.
know, but to that point, Elwood, I saw that, and I've also seen black people say this is not our fight, and I'm scratching my head because this is a time that we really are trying to build a multiracial, multinational, multi-layered united front against fascism, and so everybody needs to be there in some form of fashion. And so I'm looking at, like, for example, who's leading, who are the speakers. But for me, when you talk about the local struggles, you have this big wave of folks who are in protest of what's going on. How does that translate to a local level? And what are you asking people to do when they come out? Some of them who are coming out for the very first time. And
Let me,
so I might
Mr. Fletcher, I know
go
he
ahead.
wants to, but that makes me so annoyed why people say this is not our fight. That is absolutely ridiculous. How on earth, this is a government, this is an administration that is legally declaring war on black people, not just black people, women, other non-whites, Latinos. I mean, they're trying to
Everybody
deport you,
except for white
Latinos.
males, white billionaire males.
And straight white males are that, because if you're a white man, LGBTQ plus people, if you're not straight white male heterosexual, I mean, those areas, they're declaring war on you. Okay, so I don't know how on earth can you say this is not our fight. That is, I mean, to be like, it's
Yeah,
supposed to
no, it runs me the wrong
awesome.
way too. Bill, what do you think we can be doing now with all this momentum? How should it look on the local levels?
So I think there's so many things I want to say right now, Jamal, but let me just focus on your specific question. We have time. I want to go back to this issue of black folks and the demos, because I just wrote something about it. We have to focus on November. So what needs to happen in every city is that organizations like OBS, organizing committees of standing for democracy, local unions, churches need to convene broad-based discussions about what scenarios we could be up against in November. And it needs to be like planning a military operation. And so it needs to look at what are the possibilities and the probabilities in terms of what the other side will do in November to undermine the election. Everything from massive disinformation campaigns to paramilitary attacks to ICE to what we just saw yesterday with this fool signing an executive order against mail-in balloting after this guy mailed in a ballot just the other day, right? So in every locale, we need to have those discussions and it needs to be broad. The second part of that is then figuring out what do we do in response to those potential assaults. The third thing is then how to respond specifically at the level of organization. So I've been saying to people, we need to have a 21st century nonviolent Minutemen all over the country. We have to have people organized so that they know who to touch base with when the word is given. They know what to do. They've been trained. And regardless of what organization, church, mosque, temple, whatever they've been in, they can operate together. That's what we need to be doing. And you don't wait until September. Because, see, I remember in 2020 sounding the alarm about this fool may try to carry out a coup. And for months, and you remember this, Jamal, for months, no one would do anything. And then all of a sudden, it was Labor Day. People said, oh, Lord, this guy may carry out a coup. And then everyone started scurrying around. We can't afford that because, see, they learn from the mistakes of 2020, and we've got to be prepared to deal with them.
I keep thinking about First of all, we know that this man needs to be pulled out of there. He is not just incompetent, he's unfit. And I've been talking about, implementing Amendment 25 for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something is wrong with him, but I know why he's still there. The folks around him are going to keep him propped up because they are benefiting from his stupidity. And they are basically orchestrating the stuff around him, half the stuff he doesn't even know what's going on. But having said that, he's still there, they're still there, and they learn their lessons pretty quickly and then adjust. We don't always do it that way, and I think we should be more nimble than they, but it doesn't always work out. So I'm looking at the fact that he signed that executive order, and you got the SAVE Act that he's doing to try to do some more damage. He's talking about sending ICE to the to local polling stations. They're talking about now creating new lists with the help of the Social Security Administration and your local state, local or state, whatever it is, entities. And so if your name is not on that list, you don't get to vote. First of all, what is Social Security doing given our I mean, the whole thing is just so bizarre and illegal, but there you have it. And so there's some sentiment that people are going to get so overwhelmed, so disgusted, so disillusioned that and it's too much trouble that they won't go vote. And of course, that's the goal. And so then they've won. So given what our local and state people are, I know in Missouri is statewide, the Secretary of State is a Republican and he's going to do whatever Trump tells him to do. So we got to deal with that. But locally, there is, quote, a somewhat Democratic government, and I'm using the big D, not the small D. And so looking at what impact could we have on some of these elections, some of the processes, some of the outreach, some of the GOTV stuff, how are you looking at that bill?
Well, I'm actually very optimistic, Jamala, and in that I think that the Republicans are going to be swamped in the fall, and that's why they are so desperate right now. And so, one thing with which I will, where I'll agree with the liberals, is that there has to be a massive turnout of voters, and one part of responding to the disinformation is that in all of our cities, we have to have information centers at a bare minimum. We should have information centers so that people know who to call to get reliable information about the elections. Because, see, I think that there's very real possibility there'll be emails, right? So I'll get an email. They'll say, Mr. Fletcher, we do not have you listed as registered in your district. If you show up to vote, you will be arrested, right? Now, and then people are going to get that and they're going to panic and they're not necessarily going to know who to call. And they're going to just stay home. We have to have an alternative source of information. And so I think we can do it. But I think that the danger from the repressive apparatus, specifically ICE, the paramilitaries, is such that we're going to have large numbers of people at polls. To make, we're going to have to outnumber the other side.
Yeah, I understand that. And I'm also encouraged because all I'm doing is, first of all, looking at the elections that have happened so far.
Right.
All definitely a blue
Absolutely.
wave,
That's
a
right.
blue wave. So, and some of these are in, Republican districts. So I'm highly encouraged by what we're seeing. And it's not based on some kind of like, magical stuff. It's like people on the ground organizing and doing exactly what we're talking about. I'm going to move us now to the Cesar Chavez tragedy. I call it a tragedy because this man has such an illustrious history of fighting for farm workers and then to have this come out. And so it's definitely a stain, but I think it fits right into some of the narrative and struggles that people like myself and others who have been fighting against sexual violence and women's oppression for a long time. And still we have people who will say, why, who are these women? Why are they coming now? Same thing with P. Diddy, same thing with, Epstein, like why? So it always lets me know that we still have a lot of work to do. What's your take on the Cesar Chavez thing?
I was heartbroken. I have to tell you, Jamala, that for more than 30 years, I've been hearing strange stories about the way that the United Farm Workers was operating. Nothing about sexual harassment, just to be clear, but that under Chavez, there was suddenly a turn in the direction of paranoia, purges. And a lot of creepy, cultish things that resulted in them losing a lot of good people and the organization shrinking. I've been hearing this for years, and many veterans of the UFW did not want to talk about it very much. Only in the last 10 years or so have more people wanted to talk about it. But hearing about this, there's a politician that I know of, I'm not going to mention a name, who was engaged in a completely inappropriate activities. And one of the people he was engaged with was a dedicated member of his campaign who was basically forced to have sex with him. And this person held on to this for decades. And part of it was exactly what Dolores Huerta said, that in both cases, they did not want to destroy the movement by making these revelations. And so part of what I think needs to happen is there need to be real discussions about what do you do in situations like this? How should this be handled? Because it's going to happen again. It's not like, oh, this is it. Everyone's learned their lessons. It's going to happen again. So how does this get handled within social movements, within political campaigns, et cetera? I'm hoping that that's something that comes out of this.
Yeah, that's what I would like to see because I know that it happens in this silence for a long time. And even for non-political people, that's exactly the thing that they say. Black women will say, I don't want him to be caught up in the system. I already know it's, repressive. And so I'll just suck it up. Why? Why are we the ones that have to suck it up? And so I get the point that we don't have a vehicle internal or otherwise, that gives women a voice. And so what happens is when they finally can't take anymore and they reveal, then people, or sometimes it's actually psychologically repressed. And when it does come out, people are like, oh, here we go again. They're just trying to bring down somebody. It really is a pretty messed up system, particularly for women, but it does not even give men or boys an outlet to grow and develop. And so I just think, the more that we talk about it, talk about sexual assault, even as it relates to Epstein. I know some people don't even want to talk about Epstein because, one, thank goodness for his racism, because not very many black women were part of the girls. But still, we got Epstein's all over the place. We got them at the McDonald's who are abusing some of the young workers who need that job, and so they're everywhere, Bill, like you said. And so to me, I really want to raise it to the level of having a system-wide discussion in our movements about this, so that women feel like there's an internal process that's going to be supportive of them, and then outside of that, because sometimes it may not even get to going through a system if we do it right. If we can make women feel whole without going into the system that's going to then abuse her, abuse him, it's a no-win when you take it that far.
That's
But
right.
yeah, I just go ahead, Elwood.
I was just obviously, like a lot of people, I was certainly disappointed. I guess I was devastated, but I was disappointed when I heard the revelations. And part of me saying, well, like I said, it does show, does that take away from the accomplishments of the movement, what they were able to do? No, it doesn't diminish that. But he's a member of a long line of men who have, historically speaking, who have, achieve power, but also abused it at the same time, exploited it because of their status. We look, as much as we love Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we know he was an adulterer. I mean, can we know that he stepped outside of his marriage? Not just him, Lyndon Johnson, we know he stepped outside of his marriage. John F. Kennedy, I mean, and
And
look,
let's
on
not go through the athletes.
that's not even start there. I mean, that's the, or entertainers, entertain. But I'm just, but and I hopefully this is taken the right way what I'm about to say. But I mean, if you look at historically speaking, Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Martin Luther King Jr., we all know that they stepped outside of marital vows. On the other hand, to our knowledge, Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon, Herbert Hoover, and did not. Now, one could argue who were the more effective leaders for our time. I mean, Roosevelt. And Frank, his wife Eleanor too had, she had her lovers and things as well. The point is, they got us to a very dangerous time in American history that we could other somebody else been in office, we may not have. You may we survive. That was a very crucial time in our nation's, in the world history for that matter. The 30s and the 40s. We had a madman in Europe who was bent on conquering the entire world. I mean, so things could have went another way. So a lot of times, Martin Luther King Jr. I think was, I mean, it's abnormal. I mean, because I saw that abnormal a lot of ways. He was very abnormal in a lot of ways. Abnormal is not always a bad thing. A lot of times it's good. And first of all, he had to be abnormal because a normal person would not have done what he'd done at that time, could not have done what he had done. It was through the pressure and went through all that humiliation, he went through all that, that threats and death threats. A normal person could not have done that. So, I mean, so I think in some ways people are flawed, but they could be the right person at the right time for that vehicle. And for that movement, and that's what I'm trying to say. By no means am I condoning and supporting adultery and being unfaithful to your partner. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's more complex than that. And I think Cesar Chavez may have been the right person at the right time for that situation. This is not by no means what Dolores Huerta and others had to go through. That was a shame, and it was despicable. Although I do think what you're seeing now, a young woman, I think that's more of a generational belief. I think younger women nowadays are more inclined to speak out as well. We saw that even with men, especially women of color, the Clarence Thomas, when he was being nominated for the Supreme Court. This is just another effort of a black woman taking to try to take down a black man to use a black woman. Da, da, da. I mean, Clarence Thomas has been nothing but adversarial to the black community. I mean, his stuff as well. So, I mean, a lot of times, I think a lot of women have got to the point, younger women have came to the point, I'd say Gen Zers in particular, maybe some Gen Xers and millennials. A lot of them refer to themselves as womenists. They call
Yeah,
themselves womenists.
and that has not been isolated. It's been like generations of helping to support those women as they're going through the process and creating an environment where they feel comfortable with doing that. Bill, you want to jump in?
Yeah, see, I think it's important though to make a real distinction. We're not talking about adultery. See, first of all, my view of most situations is, unless I'm in bed with someone, actually, I don't know what they're doing, right? So I'm very cautious about commenting on what someone is doing outside of their relationship. But in the case of Chavez, in case of numerous other people, we're not talking about adultery. We're talking about violence. We're talking about violence being carried out or implied in one way or another. I think that distinction is incredibly important to make. The woman that I mentioned, that I knew, was basically told she needed to go into this candidate's bedroom and take care of him. That's not adultery, right? And so I think that distinction is really important to make, that we're talking about violence, whether carried out or implied, that this movement cannot ever tolerate. The fact that Dolores Huerta had two kids of Chavez's out of wedlock was not about adultery. He forced that on her. And there's a price that should have been paid for that. That's what I think that we have to
Oh, yeah.
really get at here. You know, and because I think if we blur the distinction, we miss the nature of this as a violent activity.
And I think that's part of the education that some of us have been trying to do over the years. Trust Black Women was a campaign that went on, you know, for some time. It's what got us to getting R. Kelly, you know, finally, after like years of dogging him and getting women, particularly who were going to his concerts, to understand what this really was about. It's a very difficult thing in the Black community, and so
Also, too, it's important
yeah.
too. And also,
Go
too, it's
ahead.
very absolutely, as Bill says. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that was that. The violence and adultery can be two different things, and they can also be simultaneously. They can be, you know. That being said, what I'm saying is that no, Chavez should have paid a price. What I'm saying at that time, she said herself, the reason why she didn't come out is because she didn't want to discredit the movement. You know, she remained quiet about it because she didn't want to discredit the movement, and that's what happened. I mean, even in the case with Anita Hill didn't come forward. It was the National Organization of Women that released her name when she was at, you know, those they're the ones who, because they were upset about Clarence Thomas because of his views on abortion. That's what that was about. You know, they felt he would be anti-abortion. So that was about, so I'm saying, it wasn't like she came forward. She gave herself, she remained quiet about it. You know, but I'm saying, but it, she was leaked. Her name was leaked to the press when it came out. People blamed Anita Hill, but it was, and now National Organization of Women who released this, even herself, she didn't come forward about it. But I'm saying,
Yeah.
and to me, that, but what I'm looking at is, I'm saying, I think the generation of women now would probably be less inclined to endure that. I mean, today we probably have a woman, a particular Gen Z woman or a millennial woman, would come out and say, yes, I've been the victim of abuse by Cesar Chavez or whoever the case would have been. It would have not been nowhere near. And also, we're in a different climate today, too. I think that, in the sense that, you know, we've had much more media outlets. And women, even since the 60s, have had more, you know, more organizations for women. And women are more inclined to, the more vehicles nowadays that, you know, that even that, although there are people trying to repress these movements and trying to, you know, retard them politically, so to speak, that women have more vehicles and resources today than they did at that time as well, particularly women of color, you know.
Well, they have more, but not a whole lot. And I just want to say, this is
Oh.
not totally about those folks who have high power jobs. They're everyday working class women
Right.
who are getting raped by partners, by, so they still feel trapped and don't have a voice. And so to me, this needs to be an ongoing conversation about how we in our
Absolutely.
movement deal with this stuff. And speaking
Absolutely.
of war on women, I'm just thinking about us, this whole war that we've engaged in Iraq. And I just recently wrote about that to say that, you know, Trump has met another bully, and it might have been the wrong bully he picked on this time, because this man, and I've read that they've been waiting for this for 40 years, and so they are totally planning this out, and they seem to be like doing okay in terms of their resistance. But a couple of things have evolved, and I've been trying to keep my folks, you know, engaged and understanding like how much money is being spent, like $2 billion. I mean, they just this money just going up in smoke pretty much. But here's a couple of things that have happened that we've found out, and that is this whole betting on the strikes, like which strikes are going to hit what. And some of this is inside betting. So that to me is just totally sick. And then the other thing that Robert Reich, who's, you know, former Secretary of Labor, reminded us of is that at least 50 Congress people have stock in defense contracts. So my point is, I'm wondering, how can we expect the Congress to do much of anything if they're in on it, you know? And I know all of them aren't. There's some people that are trying to take a stand. But yeah, this is getting more complicated than I think the average viewer looks at. So one thing that we
it's not
know.
Not really all that complicated, because I said during the last podcast, I said the Democrat Republican Party are both in the pockets of special. I mean, the military industrial complex, you've got, rumor had it was Pelosi's husband was involved in it. I'm saying you got Democrats and Republicans, I call it the military industrial complex, because both parties are involved. I mean, the Pentagon was told about 20 years ago, the Pentagon told them, we don't need any more military weapons. They said, well, you get them anyway. Because that way, politics.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. Because Elwood, I've told folks about, go to see who gets AIPAC money. There's a website that'll tell you all the Congress people get it, how much they're getting, and to the dollar, almost all of the Black Legislative Caucus, Congressional Caucus, are in the pockets of AIPAC. So again, my point is, like, how do we put pressure on them to do the right thing when all of them are benefiting from wars in the military industrial complex? And I know this thing goes all the way back to 1953. 1953, when the US decided, oh, BP is losing oil, let's overthrow this secular government. So now you got what you got. And sometimes, again, because we're all historians, you have to take people back to the reason there's so much conflict in the Middle East is because of, particularly America, the US, and then the other European folks who got interest there. So this stuff is a mess because of this country and its policy. And we need to be aware of that, because it's our dollars and people are looking at us like, what come y'all can't control your folks over there? What can we zero people in on right now to help them understand what's going on and what are the pressure points for us right now?
I think a lot of people do understand what's going on, and that's why this is the first war since polls have been taken that a U.S. president has initiated where it was unpopular before the war started. And even in his own ranks, I was listening to some information about the National Conservative Political Action Committee convention, and there's splits there around the war and around Trump. What I think is important for everyone to understand is that this is going to get worse. And it's going to get worse in part because Trump went into this with no clear objectives and does not know how to end it. And unless Pakistan is able to mediate a solution, I'm not saying that jokingly, they're the mediating force now, right? This could get worse. Gas prices will go up and up, which will have effects on the rest of the economy. We're going to be in deep doo-doo. What to do? So I think part of what we have to do goes full circle back to the discussion about protests. And I would say that we have to stop doing weekend protests. And we need to start doing Monday through Friday protests. We need to make things very uncomfortable for the elite.
Disruption.
Disruption. When we're doing our things on Saturdays and Sundays or whatever, protests on Saturdays, praying on Sundays, it's like they don't care. I mean, it unnerves them in certain ways, but not enough. And so part of what we have to do is escalate the level of pressure around this. And there's a lot of support, because people are in opposition to this war. The history, I would say, Jamal, the history goes back to World War I. In order to understand the Middle East, you gotta go back to World War I and what happened at the end of that. And the colonial powers, and then you have the entry of the United States with its dealings with Saudi Arabia in the 30s and then following. And so that history, people actually want to know. But, you know, my experience is that when you talk to people about history in the right way, their eyes brighten up, right? And they widen, and it's like, wow, I didn't know that. Why didn't I know that? That's what we want. So I think that that's part of the work that our organizations need to be doing right now. And the last thing is, we got to primary some of these officials, certainly in the Democratic Party. that are hooked up with AIPAC or receiving a lot of military money. We've got to make that an issue. So we have to have candidates that are going to run seriously, not symbolic candidates, seriously run.
So, Elwood, I'm pretty sure you saw it when Bibi Netanyahu came, bypassed the president to come talk to the Congress with no problems. He got like something like 36 standing ovations. And I saw
Well,
Democrats and
President Obama.
Republicans standing up.
Obama. Was this President Obama?
No, Netanyahu
No, I'm
came
saying
and
this
talked.
is during when Obama was president, you mean?
No, this was recently.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and so I saw people standing up, both Republicans and Democrats. And so, to Bill's point, like the ones that we have some control over, these are the ones who are in Democratic districts that we vote for. What other kinds of pressure can we be putting on them other than like protests, particularly ones that may not be up for re-election real soon?
Well, as I said, I think right now, I guess one of the things you have to do is grassroots. I've always said we need more than two parties in the United States anyway. I think we, because right now they're both parties are not, it's almost like I call like Tweedledee and Tweedledum. I mean, I think they're both in the pocket of Washington. I think they're both in the pocket of special interest and about, and like I said, I think we got to get the money out of politics, period. I mean, that's just, I think Citizens United and Hobby Lobby was a terrible Supreme Court decision, because I think that just, people could donate money. And, you got some candidates getting $50 or $60 million. When people are giving you that type of money, they're expecting something from you. Your politicians are bought and paid for. Okay. So I think to me, we got to get the money out of the politics, first of all. And I think it's going to have to be a reconstruction of some sort. That's a political reconstruction, I think. And I think we're kind of headed that way. Well, as historians, we all know, like I said, I think we're kind of in a civil war right now. And I think you're going to see a reconstruction next couple of years. I think most, because both Americans, I think, whether it's the traditional Republicans, traditional Democrats, I think most Americans, all political ideologies, are fed up with business as usual the way it is right now. And I think that's going to be right for that. Now, answer your question is, what I say, how do we, what do we do? We like you said, we've got to start, like I said, we've got to, targeting candidates and say, and get more aggressive when we say, if we have to even move around the media, mainstream media, because they're only going to publish what they, they've got their candidates they like too. Like, this is what's going on. Go your start your own town hall and say, look, these are the candidates. Here is her or his record on this, and this. Now this is out here. Now this is, obviously, if you don't agree with this, then you need to support the opposition. I mean, people have to be, well, as Bill was saying, they have to be aware of what this person stands on, who they're supporting, where their money's coming from, and stuff as well. Because otherwise, a lot of times we don't. We just assume because somebody's this or that or whatever, they're automatically, they're a Democrat, therefore they're for us. They're a Republican, they're not for us. I mean, it's not that black and white, so to speak. And I think that's going to be something we're going to have to really do. And also, some people may not listen like this, but I feel if we can't always just look at it in strictly racial terms. Some people get upset with Bernie Sanders and stuff because he thinks it's economic. But the reality is this. We are going to have people who we need to work. People need to work. People have your own agenda and interests at that point. For example, even though all of us are black, we could move. We might approach somebody, but we might go. Let's say we found ourselves in a black conservative community. I wouldn't work well in that kind of community. I mean, necessarily. I mean, let's say it was a black nationalist community. I wouldn't work necessarily well in that. But I'm just saying, exclusionary community. I'm just saying we have to find people that have our own agenda working, and irrespective of race. I mean, I'm not sure it's going to be just racial. It's going to have to be people have our own agenda, sense of justice, sense of, fairness. And I think that's going to be more important down the road, as opposed to just, well, somebody's black or somebody's white or somebody, we can work with them, we cannot work with
Somebody's
them.
male, female, straight, gay. Yeah.
Yeah,
Can
because
I
you
go
got
back
women
to
that are
the point?
anti-female.
Yeah, exactly. I did a thing about every woman is not a feminist for a black commentator. So one of the things you talked about is a civil war, and I've been saying look for it to escalate just because of what's going to happen going up to the midterms. And you wrote a piece on like Hitler and the racial identity piece and how those folks were used. And I'm thinking about the little thugs over there in Gaza who, with the sort of tacit support of the Israeli, or going through these communities, beating up, killing Palestinians with no nothing happening to them, because again they look like they're doing the work of the government without being official, kind of like what the Ku Klux Klan did. We know that they pretty much were doing what the government wished they could do, but it was not going to be totally acceptable. I'm just looking at the way that race is going to play into some of these local fights where people feel disenfranchised and start doing stuff, acting out and going after people that they think are vulnerable, and what that could look like between now and even the end of the year, and how communities protect themselves.
Again, there's gonna be, there's got to be some, with ice armor. There's got to be some armor resistance. I think there's got to be some, definitely people, almost, exercising that Second Amendment heart, right to bear arms if you need to. It might come to that. So, but I feel that we have to, be ever vigilant, and I think we're gonna have to be more inclined to, it's time to, I don't know, people just, I think a lot of people are trying to keep their heads down and, well, this, I think this mindset, this too shall pass. Yeah, but that's not always the best way to go. I mean, I think a lot of people say, well, I just keep my head down. I won't say any, I won't make any trouble, then I'll be fine. But I say, as Al Lord, again, I'm quoting her a lot today, but she said, your silence will not save you. Okay. And I
Right.
think that, don't assume because you're silent and you don't make any waves, that you're going to be safe. That's not the case. I mean, so, and I mean, so I think that, it's important for you. If you want to live in a democracy, either you have freedom or you don't, to speak and to do what you want to do. And as soon as you, suppress that, then forget it. I mean, that is the case. Bill, you made a point where you said that, I agree, the weekend protests in and of themselves may not be enough, but it is a start, and it's still better than not having any protests. But I agree, we have to start doing, those 2 day protests need to become 3, 4, 5 daily protests if possible. Now, a lot of people work during the week and everything else too, so that, it's easier said than done on some for some people. But the reality is that, but I do realize this has to be a sustained effort. It cannot be,
Yeah.
sporadically. It
Yeah.
cannot
And
be sporadically.
I'm for less protest and more strategic interruptions,
Good
disruptions.
point.
Bill,
Good
what are
point.
we going to do to save our communities and our individual selves when we are at a certain point going to have random people with, sticks, maybe even guns, going through our communities mad at the world and targeting folks that they think are the problems?
That's why I said we need 21st century nonviolent Minutemen. And
And
that's
how
all
does
I'm
that
going to
look?
say.
How would that look in our community? I'm not
Oh,
talking
I
about
think
details, but who would be a part of that, and how would people be recruited? Because I've had people come up to me to say, and there's even some gun clubs that Black folks are doing, and they're doing it openly, having to shoot, and
exactly.
And so people are calling themselves getting ready. But it's not necessarily in an organized way. And so, how could our communities organize differently? But they first have to believe that there is harm that could come to them. If you think that harm is not coming to you, or that you can call somebody like the popo, that's not going to work either. I mean, we got police here that don't even respond to calls. So if you think you're going to call and get some help, you're just going to be waiting. So I'm mentally, I think even that is a place for people to start. What do you think?
But that goes back to what I was saying about scenario planning. See, and I think that you can't just say to people, we're in danger. We have to get the key leaders in our communities together to appraise the situation, and they have to become aware of the dangers, but they also have to point out the dangers. So that's why it's a collective process. It's not one way. It's not just like us saying, hey, if we don't get our stuff together, this is what's going to happen. It's like, okay, in St. Louis, what are we to anticipate the other side is going to do? And then how do we respond? What level of defense? I think that there need to be, for instance, community patrols.
Right. Yeah. And the ideas of community controls is not new. We've
Right,
had
it's
those
not.
since the 30s and 40s, really.
Right, but they always fall apart. After the crisis is over, they fall apart, and we're going to have to sustain them because we are in a cold civil war.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. I want to thank my guest today. It is Black Commentator Wednesday, Bill Fletcher and Elwood Watson. Thank you for sharing your insights. It was so we could have done an hour on each one of those topics for real.
Indeed.
But you did give me food for thought. If you want to see some of the writings, go to blackcommentator.com and you'll see, for example, Elwood Watson's latest piece. I think maybe tomorrow you'll have the latest issue coming out. But Bill, you
Right.
said you just wrote about something. Where is that going to appear?
I'm not sure yet. My fingers are crossed. So I'll keep you posted.
Okay, let me
All right.
know and I could
All
do a
right.
link to from my
Very
column to
good.
yours. But yeah, we always writing, y'all. We always got an opinion and always trying to
Okay.
share it with you so that we help engage and amplify and expand our conversation so that each one is teaching one and it's actually helping our movement. Yeah, this is
Okay.
Jamala, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. Thank you for listening, and I will see you on some battlefield, especially the one
Take
tonight.
care. Bye, everyone. We're still on.
No procrastination. Now the time to do the right thing.